Hello, and welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and before I get started, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for listening. I took a bit of a break after the last episode, due to the holidays and keeping myself busy, but I'm excited to be back in 2017, and to kick things off with a bang. A story that harkens back to the heyday of UFO sightings in the 1960s. I know some of you may be disappointed with this being kind of an oddball subject matter, but I'm having some fun with it. I enjoy these type of stories that don't involve shady murders and dismemberments, so I can only hope that you find it as interesting as I do. If you'd like to learn more about how to support the podcast, listen through to the close and learn about all the Patreon perks I've set up and all that jazz, I won't bore you with it right now. But now, without any further ado, let's turn back the dial and head back to the early 1960s in the northeastern United States. Betty and Barney Hill are not what usually come to mind when you think of a couple in the 1960s. For one, they were an interracial couple at a time in America where that wasn't very customary. Barney was an African-American of Ethiopian heritage who had been born in 1922 in Newport News, Virginia, as the youngest of four children. As a young man, he enlisted in the United States Army during World War II, before being honorably discharged at the end of the conflict. Afterwards, he enrolled at Temple University and would later marry a woman named Ruby Horn, with whom he had two children. Eventually, Barney Hill and Ruby would divorce, but Barney would find another love, who he would remarry, a white woman named Betty. Eunice Elizabeth Barrett, usually referred to as Betty, was a couple of years older than Barney, having been born in June of 1919, but had a similar background. The life she had led was that of a respectable social worker, whose work left her as an esteemed member of the community. She had her master's degree in social sciences from the nearby University of New Hampshire, and had become the supervisor of her local child welfare department. Barney and Betty would fall in love, and throughout the following years, would remain so, even though their coupling would see them go through treacherous territory as far as relationships go. No one would ever question the bond that the two had. The two would move to Betty's native Portsmouth, New Hampshire. There, they lived about an hour north of Boston, Massachusetts, where Barney would commute to every day for work. He found a job as a postal worker, and that was a job that he would hold on to for years. As I stated, the two were very well regarded in their community. There wasn't a lot that was unique or quirky about them. Barney served as a member of the local Civil Rights Commission at a time where race relations were a very tumultuous matter. The two might have been shielded by living in one of the most liberal areas of the United States, at the time at least, but were very involved in the ongoing racial debate. Barney received multiple commendations for his work with the civil rights movement, including being honored for his outstanding service to the community by the governor of New Hampshire. He was even invited to the inauguration of Lyndon Johnson in 1963, just to give credence to his renown in this New England community. Both were also very active in their local chapter of the NAACP, and were pioneers in their own way, being an interracial couple. In the years since, people have seen all of this as a point in favor of their credibility, while others have seen it as a way to disparage their allegations. The former camp see them as the type of couple that wouldn't want to draw attention to themselves, while the latter view them as a couple that would have probably been beset by stress not faced by most of us. Regardless of your thoughts on how being an interracial couple in this era of time could have weighed upon their state of mind, it was the dawn of fall in 1961 that the lives of the Hills were reaching a tipping point. From this point forward, there would be no going back to normality for either Barney or Betty. Many articles have questioned Barney's personal health as August bled into September of 1961. A good handful of websites have pointed out that Barney had recently been diagnosed with an ulcer, which led to both him and Betty taking some time off of work. Unfortunately, I can't find a legitimate source for that claim, so I'd offer that up with just a grain of salt. However, the fact that Barney and Betty took a brief vacation to nearby Niagara Falls is without dispute. Roughly 500 miles west of where they were living in Portsmouth, the Hills had decided to drive the distance to the landmark on the US-Canadian border. They took with them their dog, a dachshund named Delcy, who you could find in many photos of the couple online. After staying at Niagara Falls for a day or two, the couple made their way northeast to Montreal, Quebec. It was there that they stayed for another few days. The exact estimates of the trip I couldn't tell you. But on the night of September 19th, the Hills began making their journey back to the real world. That evening, they stopped at a restaurant in Oulbrook, New Hampshire, and then got back on the road for the last leg of their trip home. Then, their idea of what was real or not was turned on its head forever. The following is audio from a hypnosis session Barney Hill would undertake in 1964.
I think I will stop. I will stop. And I have not stopped. And Betty said, "Look, there's a star moving." And I look and I see a star. Funny. But I said, "Betty, that's a satellite. We are seeing a satellite." And then I pulled over to the side of the road. And Betty jumped off her side, on her side, with the binoculars. And I got the chain. And I hooked it to the dog on her collar. And I say, "Come on, Dulcie, let's get out." And I look toward the sky, and I look back to Dulcie and walk her around the trunk of the car. And I'm saying, "Hurry up, Betty, so I can get a look." And Betty passes the binoculars to me. And I see that this is not a satellite. It is an airplane.
This audio is taken straight from that hypnosis session Barney Hill would undergo with noted psychiatrist Dr. Benjamin Simon in January of 1964. As a publisher's note, I do have to add that I edited the clip just a tad, taking out some of the pauses for the sake of brevity. But the audio itself is Hill's alleged subconscious mind explaining what happened on the night in question. According to his statements, along with what has been said by his wife Betty in the years since, the couple were driving along US Route 3 on their way back from Montreal. They were approaching the New Hampshire town known as Indian Head when they spotted a bright light in the sky. This is from an interview with Betty Hill, conducted in 1999, almost 40 years later.
Well, we had crossed over the border into New Hampshire, and I think we started to see this light following. Actually, in the very beginning, I noticed a bright light in the sky, and I thought I was discovering a new planet until it started to move. And this was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. So we stopped the car and got out to see what this, we thought it was a plane. So we stopped the car to get out to look at it. And that's when it changed direction and started coming in towards us. Now that was in about the Lancaster area. And it followed us for about 30 miles. Paced our car. Barney did in World War II. He knew planes. And he's trying to identify this. And it's flying in a very erratic manner, which was very puzzling to us. But this is 61. We'd heard UFO. Well, actually in those days they called them flying saucers. We had no idea what a flying saucer looked like. But we had no fear, just curiosity. We were trying to identify this craft.
Betty, who had long been fascinated by the stars in the heavens, along with the United States' growing fascination with flying saucers, began to speculate about what the light may be. Barney, a former Army vet who had served in World War II, wasn't as huge of a fan of this predicament as his wife was.
And I am thinking, this is strange, because it is still there. And Betty said, I think she said, "I am mad with her," I said. "I believe Betty is trying to make me think this is a flying saucer." Was it light enough to see? It was just a light moving through the sky. And I heard no noise. And I think, this is ridiculous. And Betty, it is not a flying saucer. What are you doing that for? You want to believe in this thing, and I don't. And I can't hear anything. any sound.
No sound, whatever.
I want to hear a jet. Oh, I want to hear a jet so badly.
Why do you want to hear a jet?
Because Betty is making me mad. She is making me angry.
According to both Betty and Barney, the craft in the sky began to follow them as they drove along the highway.
And at that point, it left the top of the mountain, came out over the highway, and stopped in midair directly in front of us, maybe about 50 feet in the sky. So Barney got out with the binoculars in an attempt to identify the craft. And when he looked up, he saw a circular window with a bright light behind it, and he saw these men standing behind the window looking down at him. And at that point, the craft began to descend, and he became frightened, ran back to the car saying he thought they were trying to capture him. So we got in the car and we went speeding down the highway to avoid capture. And as we're driving along, there's beeping sounds. It sounds like something was hitting the trunk of the car, and the car vibrated. And then we drove along for about another 30 miles when Barney turned off onto a side road. And here were the group of men he'd seen on the craft standing in the middle of this road, blocking our way. And naturally, he had to stop the car. And they came up in two groups, took us out of the car, passed in the woods to where the craft was on the ground.
What I'm about to play for you is Barney's recollection of the same events. Regardless of your thoughts on whether the story is legitimate or not, you cannot deny that Barney was somehow traumatized by this memory.
You can remember everything now.
It's right over my right. God. What is it? And I try to maintain control so Betty cannot tell I am scared. God, I'm scared.
It's all right. You can go right on. Experience it. It will not hurt you now.
I got to get my gun.
Oh! I got to get my gun!
All right. Oh! Oh! All right. That's all. Deeply relaxed. You'll not have to make any outcry. But you can remember it now. Keep remembering. You feel you have to get your gun. This is going to harm you, yourself.
I open the trunk of my car, and I get it, and I get back in the car.
All right, just keep reasonably calm.
And I put it in my coat, and then I get out with the binoculars, and it is there. And I look, and it shifts over, and I think, I'm not afraid. I'll shoot it down if I'm not afraid. And I walk out, and I walk across the road. There it is, up there.
What you can tell from the audio is the different way that both Betty and Barney remember the event in question. To Betty, decades after the fact, it seems almost like a whimsical adventure. But Barney, whose hypnosis session was conducted just a couple of years after the evening of September 19th, remembers the alleged encounter with extraterrestrial life with a terrifying recollection. For both Betty and Barney Hill, this was just the beginning of a tale that would go on to dominate the rest of their lives. after being followed by the bright lights for miles, 30 or so by Betty's later recollections. The couple pulled over just outside of Indian Head, New Hampshire. There, they recalled encountering the inhabitants of the odd craft, whom they both considered men of odd variations. However, at this point, their memory gets murky. They recalled looking at the strange men, who looked alien-like and wore odd, glossy, black suits, but their memory began to fade. Beeps and shrill whistles dominated their senses, and before long, hours had passed. The couple were roughly 35 miles south of Indian Head, which had brought them closer to home, but they had no idea how they had just traveled that distance. What they would find is that Betty's dress had a tear in it, and the binoculars that Barney had been holding when he encountered the odd men had been ripped from his hand, the binding torn. Apparently, both of their watches had stopped working entirely, and Betty couldn't find the blue earrings that she had been wearing. The Hills themselves felt fine, including their dog Delcy, just hazy in what had happened to them. As they came back to themselves, the buzzing sound that had consumed them upon seeing the alien creatures faded away. They continued their venture home in relative silence and unease. Both Barney and Betty believed that something had happened to them, but they just couldn't point their finger on exactly what that was. They both felt dirty and gross. When they pulled into their Portsmouth home, it was close to 5 o'clock in the morning, and there was apparently a large chunk of the evening and early morning that was now absent, having been totally vacated by their memory. They decided that the items they had had with them in the car should remain on the back porch for a few days, because Barney, the army vet, was oddly worried about radiation poisoning. Troubling, as well, were a handful of small, circular, metallic spots on the trunk of the couple's 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air. These had apparently not been there beforehand, and didn't look like anything that could be caused by an accident. Betty, who had noticed a tear on her dress, also discovered some pink powder on the surface of it. She apparently threw the dress away, but would dig it out of the trash within a few days, thinking it provided a clue to the missing hours. The two would go on to take long, extensive showers. Barney recalled that he felt compelled to examine himself in the bathroom, particularly his genitals. Before they could fall asleep, the couple felt compelled to discuss what they had seen, and made some crude drawings to try and demonstrate what their memory allowed. Fruitless, their memory not returning to them in any productive way, the two decided to go to bed. The sun was now rising, on the last day of summer, so both Betty and Barney lay down in their bed, feeling unsure of whether they were both collectively losing their minds. That afternoon, after waking up, Betty decided to call her sister, Janet. You see, this wasn't the first time that a member of Betty's family had claimed to have encountered a UFO. Janet had claimed to have seen one a few years beforehand, back in 1957, although the specific circumstances of that sighting aren't known publicly. Janet referred Betty to the nearby Peace Air Force Base. Betty reluctantly followed up on her sister's advice, placing a call to the Strategic Air Command at that installation. She apparently told an investigator about the sighting of the strange craft, and then received a more earnest callback the next day from Major Paul W. Henderson, who would take the official statement from the couple. They withheld some of their more outlandish thoughts, such as perhaps seeing strange alien-like men, but reported what they had seen with the craft, the shape, how it moved, etc. Apparently, during this conversation, Major Henderson informed the Hills about an observation the Peace Air Base radar had picked up at approximately 2:14 that morning. Now, this has never been confirmed by anyone involved in the military, so take it with a grain of salt, but this would roughly fit in with the timeline that the Hills would establish over the next few years. Henderson would spend the next few days with the report he was working on, full of the information that the Hills had given him. He would file the report on September 26th, 4 days after his conversation with Betty and Barney. The conclusion that he would reach was that the couple had misidentified the planet Jupiter, or seen some type of optical illusion caused by the planet, which was very visible on the night in question. However, this report would be forwarded to Project Blue Book, which was the United States government's organizational response to the UFO sightings that had been cropping up since the late 1940s. During the conversation with her sister Janet on September 21st, Betty was told to check the small, circular spots left behind on their vehicle's trunk. Janet recommended bringing a compass out, and see how it reacted to the spots. According to both Betty and Barney, the compass would begin to react dramatically when brought in close to the metallic spots. Apparently, the compass would begin to spin chaotically when brought close to them, but would drop back to normality when taken just inches away. To Barney, this was a sign that something was off. To Betty, though, this was a sign that what had happened to them was extraordinary, and perhaps even out of this world. Within the next few days, Betty began to investigate UFOs on her own time. She would travel to the nearby Portsmouth Library and began reading up on flying saucers and the claims that people had levied against them. One of the books she discovered, titled Flying Saucers Are Real, had been written by a former Marine Corps naval aviator named Donald Kehoe, who had published books about UFOs and now gone to co-found NICAP, also known as the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. The book Betty found was based on the idea that UFOs had been visiting Earth for some time, perhaps centuries, but had now started to increase their observations based on humanity's nuclear technology. The book itself was marinated in Cold War suspicions, but held on to the belief that the United States government, or at least the leaders of the government, were aware of UFO visitations and had been actively suppressing that knowledge. This book apparently whirled Betty into a frenzy. On the same day that Major Paul W. Henderson was filing his report, claiming that the Hills had simply seen an illusion of sorts, Betty was writing a letter of her own. Sent to Donald Kehoe himself, who is now the leader of NICAP, a civilian non-profit organization aimed at bringing to light claims of UFO activity, extraterrestrial and otherwise. The letter detailed everything that Betty and Barney could remember. This also included Barney's claims of seeing man-like beings aboard the strange aircraft, and noted that the couple were thinking of seeing a hypnotist to unearth any sort of mental blocks. The letter itself was mailed to Donald Kehoe, but was soon passed into the hands of a man named Walter N. Webb. From there, the story just keeps growing and growing. Over the next couple of weeks, the Hills began to settle back into their regular lives. Both Barney and Betty began to work again, but then Betty began to be plagued by dreams. For 5 nights, she had these dreams. These were dreams of her and Barney being stopped by a group of beings, who took them from their car and began guiding them towards a type of spacecraft hidden in the nearby woods. Then, the dreams began to include alleged memories of experiments performed on Betty and Barney Hill. Here's Betty's description of the encounter, taken from an interview in the 1970s.
I was taken into the first room, Barney into the second room, where we were given, as the leader, as I call him, gave us testing. There were 11 beings, and for purposes of identification, I call one the leader, because he seemed to be in charge of the project of doing this testing, and he was the only one who spoke English. Then there was the examiner who did the testing, and then there were 9 others we call crew members. They stayed outside the room in the corridor. Our examinations were very much similar in that with both Barney and I, they checked our eyes, ears, nose, throat, took samples of our hair, fingernail, and they scraped our skin. With me, they touched my body with little points on wires. He said he was checking my nervous system. And then they attempted to insert a needle-like instrument in my navel. I objected that it would hurt, and he said it shouldn't hurt. When he did this, it caused a great deal of pain. He said it was a pregnancy test, and I said, well, that's no pregnancy test here. At this point, the examiner came running back into the room and opened my mouth and started tugging at my teeth. And I said to the leader, what is he doing? And he said, we're very, very puzzled. Why are Barney's teeth removable and yours are not?
According to Betty and the memories retained within her dreams, they had been abducted by the aliens from the car and were forced into a series of tests. Apparently, Barney went through the encounter in a comatose state, while she claims to have been awake throughout most of it. These tests were mostly physical examinations, where the aliens from Betty's dream performed experiments on their nervous systems, with tiny little prods that grazed the skin. As you heard, the aliens were surprised by Barney's teeth, which he had lost in World War II after getting hit with a shockwave from a grenade. He had since been wearing dentures, which apparently intrigued the alien beings. How Betty was able to remember all of this in a series of dreams spanning 5 nights is anyone's guess. Many have alleged that she recalled, quote-unquote, remembering these events after doing an extensive amount of research into unidentified flying objects. But I should note that while sightings of flying saucers were becoming commonplace all over America, and even the world, this was one of the very first times that anyone had allegedly been abducted. If there were stories of people being abducted at the time, they weren't very well known, at least not enough for Betty to hear about them in popular culture. Now, it's easy for us to pinpoint stories like The Hills and poke fun at it, but at the time, UFO abduction tall tales hadn't entered the American zeitgeist. Just want to mention that, because one of the biggest arguments against The Hills having been abducted is that they wanted publicity, but in actuality, they worked against it for at least the first few years of the story. Now, that doesn't change the fact that Betty began to recall more of the events of their abduction the further out from the event. That is simply not how memory works, but there's still plenty left of the story to tell before I begin spouting off my own opinions. Walter N. Webb was a young man who had graduated from Mount Union College in 1954 with a degree in biology. However, he himself had a history with unidentified flying objects. In 1951, while serving as a teenage camp counselor in Michigan, Webb had witnessed an odd moving object flying in the sky above. He had become enamored with the subject, and by the time he graduated with a biology degree, he immediately went to work in the field of astronomy. His tutor, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, is one of the most prominent astrophysicists of all time. He had served as the scientific advisor to Project Blue Book since its inception in 1952, and had even advised for its predecessors, Project Grudge and Project Sign. While serving as a scientific advisor for Blue Book, he was also working as the lead for the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory's Optical Satellite Tracking Program. Webb would work under Dr. Hynek from 1957 to 1958, at which time his career path was established. He would then begin working for the Charles Hayden Planetarium in Boston shortly afterwards, where he volunteered his time for NICAP, the nonprofit organization co-founded by Donald Kehoe that investigated UFO phenomena. It was here that Webb enters the story. He was a young, aspiring astronomer that was handed the letter Betty Hill had handwritten, full of details alleging contact with an alien race, missing memories, and a promise of hypnosis to discover the supposed truth. Webb contacted the Hills and arranged for an interview to take place in October. When they finally met on October 21st, 1961, an entire month had transpired since the alleged UFO sighting, and Betty's memory seemed to be getting better and better with every passing day. During this infamous interview, which spanned nearly 6 hours, the Hills recounted every detail imaginable. From the drive home, to the extraordinary craft flying in the sky, to Betty's recollection of their abduction, it was all detailed in Webb's NICAP report, which totaled in at over 60 pages when it was finalized in 1965. In his reports, Webb insisted that what the Hills were saying seemed to be genuine. He noted that they had some inconsistencies when it came to specific points, such as the exact time that something happened, or the exact location they were at when they first saw the craft, that kind of stuff. However, he genuinely believed them, and took an open mind to their story. Also deciding to believe in the Hill story was an old friend of Barney's, Major James McDonald of the United States Air Force. The two had been friends for some time, and McDonald came to the support of the Hills when other writers came to interview them for the story. In November, two more members of NICAP came to speak with them, interviewing them about the inconsistencies in their story. Their biggest gripe with the Hills was the block of missing time from their story, roughly 3 hours worth. However, the Hills agreed with them and insisted that they wanted to learn about those 3 hours. This is when the idea of hypnosis began to seriously get floated to the Hills, and they began to look for someone who could dislodge any memories from their subconscious. Things began to look rather grim for poor Barney. While Betty was in supposed anguish with the contents of her dreams, Barney was struggling with demons of his own. Having long been sober, Barney began to drink again. It had been over a decade since he had had an alcohol problem, but his growing anxiety at something urged him to pick up the habit once again. He was becoming anxious, withdrawn, and some would say depressed. His work shift, which he had once enjoyed, now filled him with unease. According to Betty, he was driving an hour each way, 5 or 6 times a week, down to Boston to work the midnight shift as a postal worker. And after going through such an incredible affair while driving at night, I'm sure this commute didn't do him any favors. Then, things took an odd turn just a few months after the supposed abduction. He began to develop a ring of warts around his genital region, which would require 3 minor operations to do away with. Many have theorized that if he was experimented on, that this was some kind of side effect, but others have theorized that it was entirely psychosomatic in origin. And if that wasn't enough, health issues began to plague Barney. At this point in time, he was definitely dealing with an ulcer, and he would go on to develop high blood pressure in the months after September of 1961. Needless to say, it surprises no one that Barney was forced into therapy to help cope with his ever-growing list of issues. As he began to divulge his issues to his therapist, the topic of hypnosis kept surfacing, with Barney hesitant to engage in the activity due to his own insecurity. He was afraid of what may lie behind that door, so he chose not to open it. Things continued to appear normal on the outside. Barney remained active in his local NAACP chapter and in the Governor of New Hampshire's Civil Rights Commission, and in 1963, he was invited to attend the inauguration of President Lyndon B. Johnson. But as the months began to turn into years, he eventually couldn't hold back the tide of his trauma anymore. In 1964, he and Betty began to visit Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who recorded the audio sessions you heard at the beginning of the episode. Between 1962 and 1964, Betty had become more and more sure of her recollection of events. After those dreams had disappeared after roughly 1 week, she had used journals and hand-drawn photos to piece together what she could remember, and timelined it into the common recollection we know today. The multiple sessions that the Hills undertook with Dr. Simon proved fruitful, if only for Barney finally talking about what he believed happened on the night in question. In an apparent deep state of hypnosis, Barney began to tell the story as he remembered it.
"This creature, this leader, is telling me something.
He's telling you something. How? How is he getting it to you?
I can see it in his face.
Do you see his lips move? Yes.
No, his lips aren't moving.
Yes, go on. He's telling you.
And he's looking at me.
What did he tell you?
Stay there and keep looking. Just keep looking and stay there. And just keep looking. Just keep looking.
Could you hear him telling
you? Oh, I gotta pull these binoculars away from my eyes. Because if I don't, I'll just keep staying there.
Could you hear him tell you this?
Oh, no. He didn't say it.
You felt he said it.
I know.
You know he said
it. Just there. Yeah. Just stay there, he's saying to me. It's
all right.
Pounding in my head.
All right.
Pull the binoculars away. God, give me strength.
All right.
Pull them down. Run. Pull these binoculars down and run. God. If there's my God, give me strength. Gotta get away. Oh. Oh. Betty.
All right.
Gotta get away, Betty.
All right. Calm down.
I'm dying. Get away.
How could you be sure he was telling you this? Calm down, you're still asleep. How could you be sure he was telling you this?
Guys. I've never seen his eyes before.
Regardless of your thoughts on whether or not this was a true story, you cannot deny that Barney was traumatized by something. Between his testimony under hypnosis, his compounding health issues, and his reliance on substance abuse to cope with his problems, something was deeply unsettled within him. His description of the encounter with the strange craft in the sky, and the inhabitants of the craft, roughly fit in with Betty's description. They had been driving along the highway when they noticed the light, and it followed them for some time. Then they decided to get out and take a look, at which point the craft started showing an interest in them. From there, they got back in the car and decided to drive away, but then faced a blank memory and no recollection. The audio tapes made widely available of Barney under hypnosis with Dr. Benjamin Simon don't go into extensive detail about what happened after this first encounter with alien beings. But in the decades since, Betty went on the record multiple times to tell the story of what happened aboard that alien craft.
Went in to a corridor, and then I was taken into a room, and I had to step up because the floor, level of the floor, was above the corridor, and it was an oval-shaped door like we would see on a ship. I was taken into this first room, and it was quite bare. There was a small table, there was a stool, and then the wall, the door, there were doors in the wall that would slide back and forth. And they put me on a stool, checked my eyes, ears, nose, throat, my feet, my hands. And then he put me on a table and said they were going to check my nervous system. And they used some kind of equipment to do this. And then he tried to insert a needle-like instrument in my navel, which caused pain. So they stopped doing it. And the examiner left and went into the room where Barney was.
Barney showed a great deal of distress during his hypnosis sessions, as you heard. But Betty seems to recall this encounter with the alien beings as a jovial one, like a pair of friends she had not seen in some time and remembers fondly. However, I do think that it's important to note the differences that both Betty and Barney had in their recollection of the alien beings. This is perhaps one of the biggest marks against the pair in terms of their testimony and the events that occurred. Here is Barney's original description of the alien beings.
The evil face on the looks like a German Nazi.
He is a Nazi. Did he have on a uniform?
Yes.
What kind of uniform?
Black. He had a black scarf around his neck, dangling over his left shoulder.
You pointed it out as if it were on you.
I never noticed that.
He had a black scarf on his neck. How did you see these figures so clearly at that distance?
I was looking at him with binoculars.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Did they have faces like other people? You say one reminded you of a red-headed Irishman.
His eyes were slanted. I see it so. Eyes were slanted, but not like a Chinese.
Barney describes the beings as looking a lot like humans, wearing uniforms that were close to that of Nazis, black and sleek. As you heard, he even describes one of the figures as wearing a scarf, which isn't an item normally attributed to alien sightings. And as far as his description of the aliens is concerned, he describes them as having very small, slanted eyes. In this hypnosis audio tape, he also goes on at length about how they communicated telepathically. Both of these go directly at odds with Betty's own description of the alien beings, which transformed over the years.
They spoke English in a limited way, like, a foreigner coming here and not too well acquainted with our language.
Let's just go back to those type of entities. They were your classic alien gray-shaped cat-like... No, they weren't. Okay.
They were a form of human being.
They were a form of human being.
Right.
Did they have cat-like or Cheshire-like eyes?
They had larger eyes than ours. Smaller nose. And smaller mouth. No protruding part of the ear and no hair.
I would be remiss if I went without mentioning the potential outside influences on both Betty and Barney Hill's version of events. Up until this point in 1964, the story had not yet become widely known outside of their social circle. They had been struggling with events, but hadn't started to receive widespread fame because of their claims. In March of 1963, roughly a year and a half after their alleged encounter, they had spoken to their church about their claims in an effort to find peace in religion. But unfortunately, we don't know all that was said, or whether these discussions of theirs included any mention of being abducted, or even personally encountering the alien beings. Over the next few months, they would give some little lectures on what had happened to them, but remained relatively quiet about their claims. And as such, very little record can be found of their claims before this time, so we can't verify that any of the memories discovered during these hypnosis sessions weren't influenced by outside sources. In January and February of 1964, roughly the exact same time as Betty and Barney began undergoing hypnosis with Dr. Benjamin Simon, two episodes of television aired. One was an episode of The Twilight Zone titled Black Leather Jackets, and the other an episode of The Outer Limits titled The Bolero Shield. Both television episodes featured a storyline involving aliens encountering humans in gentle, friendly ways, and included imagery that may have found its way into Betty and Barney's imagination. I just mention this because I personally don't know what to think of the Hills' testimony. Many of the therapists that the pair had seen before Dr. Simon agreed that the couple had indeed gone through something dramatic. Something happened on the night in question. It's just hard to parse if any of that was extraterrestrial or otherworldly in nature. It's also important to note that Barney's description of the aliens, which he describes as looking like Nazis, might be compounded by his lingering PTSD. While I don't know the specifics of his wartime records, he did serve in World War II, and suffered an injury at the hands of a grenade, which required him to get dentures at an early age. Perhaps his memory of this encounter with alien beings triggered the part of his brain that was dealing with some severe undealt with trauma. I would like to include one last piece of audio of Barney taken under hypnosis, just to showcase that while he was definitely hiding some trauma, he was deeply in love with Betty and considered himself a happy individual.
Dulcie is under the seat, and I reached under and touched her, and she is in a tight ball under the seat, and I sit back, and I see Betty is coming down the road, and she gets into the car, and I am grinning at her, and she is grinning back at me, and we both seem so elated, and we are really happy, and I'm thinking, it isn't too bad. How funny. I have no reason to fear. And we look, and I see a bright moon. And I laugh and say, well, there it goes. And I'm happy.
While I talk mostly about Barney's hypnosis session, it's also true that Betty herself went through the same hypnosis therapy with Dr. Benjamin Simon. Apparently, her hypnosis was just as productive and emotional, with several sessions having to be cut short because of her fragile state at the end. Whenever Dr. Simon would broach the subject of her capture and abduction, she would begin to cry, which stands in clear contrast with how she has approached the matter in the years since. Betty's hypnosis sessions were very similar to the dreams she had had a few years beforehand, but filled in a lot of details, such as her description of the aliens, their craft, etc. One of the most interesting pieces of information was taken from her claim that she saw one of the aliens' maps. This map wasn't like our normal 2D planetary map, but was rather a holographic 3D star map, showcasing where the aliens were from. Now, instead of trying to explain my thoughts on the star map, I'll just turn it over to the master of astronomy himself, Carl Sagan, who covered Betty's claims on his legendary show, Cosmos.
That was the story told by Betty and Barney Hill. Virtually all scientists who've studied it are skeptical, but UFO enthusiasts think the Hill case is a classic example of a close encounter of the third kind. Why? What makes it so special?
While on board, Betty had noticed a book written in an unknown hieroglyphic writing. She was also shown a strange window through which she could see a glowing pattern of dots connected with lines. It was, they told her, a star map displaying the routes of interstellar commerce. Afterwards, the Hills were released and permitted to return home, or at least this is their story. Now, believers find this account compelling, or at least plausible, chiefly because of the alleged star map. Here's what Betty Hill said it looked like. Now, why would anybody take this seriously? Because here is a real map, widely publicized by UFO enthusiasts, of 15 selected nearby stars, including the Sun, as seen from one particular vantage point in space. This map includes stars that were first cataloged several years after Betty Hill recalled what she says she saw in the alien ship. Her map required, we are told, information that was not then available on the Earth. There is a resemblance between the two maps, but that's mainly because the lines corresponding to navigation routes have been copied from the Hill map onto the real star map. If we were to substitute some other set of lines for the Hill lines, we find that the eye suddenly is biased against seeing any agreement between the two maps at all. To make an objective test, however, let's remove the lines altogether. And then there's very little resemblance left. But these particular stars are selected from a large catalog of star positions. Our vantage point in space is also selected to make the best possible fit with the Hill map. If you can pick and choose from a large number of stars, viewed from any vantage point in space you want, you can always find something resembling the pattern you're looking for. I'm surprised that nobody could find a better fit to the Hill map. The Hill's own psychiatrist described their story as a kind of dream. There's no corroborating evidence. The star map argument is worthless. And yet, this is one of the best attested cases of UFO close encounters. For all I know, we may be visited by a different extraterrestrial civilization every second Tuesday. But there's no support for this appealing idea. The extraordinary claims are not supported by extraordinary evidence.
The map that Betty drew wasn't particularly advanced in any way, but ended up loosely matching up with the Zeta Reticuli system. This anomaly was discovered by elementary school teacher Marjorie Fish in 1968, and her theory would be expanded upon in 1969 when the Gliese catalog was released. Until then, the information about nearby star routes wasn't widely known, so it would have been theoretically impossible for Betty to have known what she did. But like you just heard Carl Sagan say, the lines and dots she put together could have been used in any number of surrounding stars, so it's evidence that doesn't draw much of a conclusion. After their hypnosis sessions, Dr. Benjamin Zeiman reached his own professional conclusion. He decided that the couple had gone through a singular psychological aberration, inspired by Betty's fantasies. He noted the differences in their accounts as proof of this conclusion, and that while there was perhaps some real trauma behind it, that the story the two had told was something from their imagination. However, through these sessions, Barney had finally grown to accept what had happened. While before, he was prepared to defend his recollection of events and deny any kind of abduction, he had started to make peace with it. Betty, on the other hand, had long since made peace with it and begun to treat the story as we know now, friendly and joyous. The Hills began to return to their regular lives once again. Barney was still working as a postal worker, and Betty as a social worker. Over the next year or so, things went back to normality, and the two had seemed to move on with their lives. In September of 1965, Walter N. Webb finished his full-length report on the Hills. Full of details gleaned from their recorded sessions with Dr. Zeiman, and the testimony that they had given over the years, the report is over 60 pages long and still available to read online. But on October 25th, 1965, they were greeted by the front page of their newspaper, the Boston Traveler. The headline, written in big bold letters, read, UFO Chiller, Did They Seize Couple? The article was about Betty and Barney, and the information the reporter obtained was taken from audio recorded during one of the Hills lectures in 1963. Apparently, the reporter, John H. Luttrell, had also learned that the couple had gone to seek hypnosis therapy with Dr. Benjamin Zeiman. Despite their efforts to stay sane in the public eye, the Hills were now celebrities. The day after the Boston Traveler published the story about the Hills, it was picked up by the United Press International, now known as the Associated Press. Before long, the pair were visited by an author, John G. Fuller, who wanted to write a book about their encounter with alien beings. They agreed to cooperate, as well as Dr. Benjamin Zeiman, who offered his professional insights. The book, titled The Interrupted Journey, was published in 1966. It details the missing chunk of time that the couple had trouble remembering, and it turned them into icons among the burgeoning UFO community. Much of the original focus on the couple was pointed at them being an interracial couple. Many have theorized that the stress of being a couple in such a time was what ultimately led to a break from reality and them concocting this story, but even Dr. Simon disagreed with that statement. While the two had been under pressure, it was most likely caused by something traumatic that had happened on the evening in question, not by societal pressures. All of their therapist, family, and friends agreed. They were a happy couple that genuinely loved one another and lived in one of the most progressive parts of the nation. Over the next few years, their popularity would continue to rise. They became well known for their allegations, and it's what ultimately might have done Barney in. In February of 1969, just a little over 7 years after the original sighting, he suffered a cerebral hemorrhage. Onset by high blood pressure and compounded by his alcoholism, Barney Hill passed away at the young age of 46, leaving behind two children and making Betty a widow at the age of 48. It's hard to say what kind of impact the fame had upon Barney's health. Many have attributed the UFO sighting to his decline of life, but it's also been pointed out that his health issues may have started before the fall of 1961. Betty would never remarry. She described the love that she and Barney had as something permanent, something that she would never be able to break free from. And while she may have gone into seclusion to live out the last half of her life in peace, she decided to remain at the forefront of the UFO movement, cementing her legacy as a peculiar individual. She would attend UFO conventions, speak out in defense of UFO sightings while also tearing down some other stories as obviously false, and would become forever known as the grandmother of UFOlogy. In 1975, the book based upon the Hills' alleged abduction, The Interrupted Journey, would get turned into a television film. Starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons, the movie was called The UFO Incident, and it aired close to 14 years after the original sighting. While some point out flaws in the story to paint the Hills as crazy people hell-bent on popularity, others point to arguments that may work in their favor. Peace Air Force Base, the nearby military installation that was originally contacted by Betty on September 22nd, did write a report and declare the matter closed just a few days later. However, Betty would continuously claim that the major she spoke to, Paul W. Henderson, confirmed her suspicions by saying that radar picked up something on the evening that they were abducted. In some stories, I've read that the radar pinged twice, once roughly 7 hours before their abduction, and once 2 hours after. And it is also true that the case was forwarded to Project Blue Book, which, as I stated, was a real governmental program aimed at identifying UFO activity. Also, Betty would continue to claim that the information obtained by the Air Force that night, pertaining to their abduction, has been classified and gone unreleased for decades. Obviously, I have no way to know if that's true, but it's still interesting to know. Also, I found this pretty unique. The 509th Bomb Wing, which was restationed to Peace Air Force Base in 1958, had previously been located in Roswell, New Mexico. In 1990, the 509th Bomb Wing was moved to Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, and now Missouri has become one of the biggest hotbeds for alleged UFO sightings in America. Betty herself remained a lightning rod for controversy over the next few decades, painting herself as an icon for the UFO community. She never shied away from her claims, in fact diluting them with many more. She would continue to see UFOs dozens of times over the rest of her life, eventually earning herself a reputation as a crazy old lady. Over the years, many have coined her as the driving force behind the Hills' claim of abduction. People have theorized that Barney, who was shying away from some personal trauma, was influenced by Betty's persistent claims of UFO abductions and simply went along with it. While some would call that weak-minded on Barney's part, it's important to note that eyewitness testimony is not relied upon by police investigators, because the mind is so easily influenced by outside sources. Perhaps Barney refused to believe Betty, but her persistent claims eventually found their way into his mind in certain ways. It's definitely possible that the two had lived through a type of shared trauma, and had simply gone with Betty's imagination as a coping mechanism. Or, perhaps, they simply just made it all up. It's impossible to know their motivations for sure, really. Because the story is just too outlandish for our minds to perceive that it actually happened in the way that they claimed. Betty did have a history of UFO stories. I noted earlier in the episode that her sister, Janet, had claimed to have seen a UFO in the 1950s, and Betty seemed to have an interest in the subject before her alleged abduction. Even in the years since, her niece, Kathleen Martin, has continued to vouch for her aunt and uncle's story, publishing a book and multiple blogs online in support of their credibility. Sadly, Betty Hill passed away of cancer in October of 2004. Over the years, UFO believers have tried to support the story that the Hills told and tried to back it up with evidence. The star map, pointing to Zeta Reticuli, remains the most solid piece of evidence, but even that is flawed. The dress that Betty had been wearing, which she claimed had been covered in a pink powder, was tested for evidence decades after the fact. The test results came back inconclusive, stating that the dress contained evidence of some kind of protein, none of which matched up with the Hills' DNA. The story has remained a staple among UFO supporters and skeptics, but few can deny the impact it had upon American culture. It immediately brought about dozens, if not hundreds, of copycat stories and people claiming anal probes from aliens above. There now exist markers along the New Hampshire highways where the alleged abduction happened, and a collection of the case's UFO materials reside at the University of New Hampshire, Betty's alma mater. Regardless of the story's merit, whether aliens and UFOs were actually spotted that night, what happened to Betty and Barney Hill on September 21st, 1961, remains unresolved. Well, the first episode of 2017 was a bit of a doozy. Took me a bit longer than intended, but I finally got it done. I personally just don't know what to believe. By and large, I think UFO stories are made-up fantasies invented by people who want fame and fortune, but there's also a part of me that relates to Mulder from The X-Files. I wanna believe. However, I think something may have happened to the Hills on the night in question. I don't know enough to say that it wasn't aliens, simply because I'm in my mid-20s and know approximately 1% of the world's information. I just can't say definitively whether or not it happened. I'd like to think that aliens exist and that they're friendly instead of being hostile, but how am I to tell? I'm like Jon Snow, I know nothing. Anyhow, that's enough of a diatribe. I encourage everyone to keep an open mind about everything, even if it sounds crazy. Actually, especially if it sounds crazy, because those are usually the most fun stories. If you'd like to keep in touch with the podcast, you could do so in a variety of ways. You could find us on Facebook, just search for The Unresolved Podcast. We're on Twitter, at UnresolvedPod, one word. You could also send an email to theunresolvedpodcast@gmail.com, or even send a text or voicemail to 831-200-3550. Over the past month or two, I've also gotten a good amount of requests for people asking about funding the show. If you're not aware, I'm trying to make a push to treat the podcast like a job, which would mean more episodes for all of you, but more work and time needed by me. If you'd like to help me make regular episodes a reality and upgrade the equipment I'm using, you could visit the Patreon page located at www.patreon.com/unresolvedpod. Just unresolved pod, one word, no spaces or anything to it. Pretty easy to find. And you could always just Google Patreon and Unresolved Podcast, and I'm sure it'll pop up. At the Patreon page, you'll get access to all the perks. For $1 a month, you just get a shout-out. However, at $2.50 a month, you start to get exclusive content, including musical tracks and the rough cut of each episode as soon as I record it. So Patreon supporters are hearing this shortly after I record it, while everyone else is hearing it a week or two later, after Tyson adds music and polishes it up and makes it sound pretty. However, at $5 a month, you actually get to voice what you want for the podcast. I open up a poll at the beginning of every month with upcoming episodes that I'd like to get to. You get a vote to decide which one you want to hear next. The next episode you'll hear is actually one of those selections, an Australian-based murder mystery that I hinted to in a prior episode. Speaking of the Patreon, I'd like to give a big thanks to the following people for supporting the podcast early on. Rebecca, Fenua, Athena, Jay, HB, Brian, Janet, Eunice, Laura, Meredith, Robin, Dan, Jennifer, Teresa, Andrew, Peter, and Akjay. Apologies for any names I may have butchered. But I really appreciate all of the support you've shown the podcast, and I can't thank all of you enough. Sincerely, thank you. But if you're interested in joining these supporters and getting your name added to the list, just visit the Patreon page and you could set up monthly donations. If you'd like to support the podcast in other ways, you could find the PayPal button at the top of the podcast website, theunresolvedpodcast.com. There you could also find links to all the music that's used and the transcript for each episode and all that fun stuff. And if you don't want to provide any monetary support, I totally understand, but I'd still appreciate it if you gave the podcast like a good review on iTunes or whatever service you're listening to. That helps me get more attention and publicity, which I would greatly appreciate. I'd also like to give a huge shout out to Tyson, who has been the backbone of the podcast over the past year or so. He's been responsible for most of the great music you've heard throughout each episode, along with the production. In this episode, he was joined by his buddy Sam, and together they created the outstanding music you've been listening to. It was an amazing touch to the episode, really helped contribute to like a 1950s sci-fi movie vibe. And honestly, I just can't thank them enough. It sounded great. Hopefully we'll be able to get Sam back for some future episodes, because his synthesizers really took things to the next level. But Tyson and Sam, thank you guys very much. I really appreciate it. As I've stated on social media, I'm trying to make an effort in 2017 to treat the podcast like I would a job. My goal is to get episodes out every 2 weeks without fail, but to justify that, I would need some help. This is why I'm hoping that anyone out there listening to this tries to help me out. Even if you don't want to make a donation, at least try and introduce others to the podcast who might. My dream is to make this eventually a regular weekly show, but to do that, I'd need your help. But I'll stop begging for help now. I really appreciate all the support everyone has already shown me, and even you listening right now is helping tremendously. Thank you so much for listening. I sincerely enjoy making the podcast. I would just like to take it to the next step in 2017, so I'll just put that in your hands. Until next time, everyone, stay safe, and watch out for those lights in the sky.